different family members come to Christ. My parents are fairly new Christians, and I've had a sisters become a Christian, many uncles and aunts and cousins. But what's remarkable about this trip, the last remaining members of the family that are not Christians are actually going to come to my speaking events. They've never heard me speak before. So that includes my sister and her son. So I think they're open in a way they've never been in their lives before. So appreciate your prayers for that. And, you know, lots happening this week. We're having a board meeting for first ever board meeting of Reasons to Believe Canada. And there is a boycott being organized against my events, but there are a lot of churches that are realizing, you know, Canadians need to really reach out to their own. And that's really the challenge we're bringing up there to this particular church it's sponsoring. This is the first church ever that's allowed me to speak in my own country. So, and it's all thanks to a gold miner from the Yukon. There's this gold miner up in the Yukon who read our books and came to faith in Christ, and he wound up sending us a nice, generous check, and he attends this church 3 weeks out of the year. That's the only time he gets to go to church. He's up in the gold fields all the rest of the time. So for 3 weeks out of the year, he's in church, and he picked this church near Vancouver, and he gave them some money to bring us up and try to present the challenge to Christians in the church in Canada to reach out to people like himself. He says, you know, the reason why I was a non-Christian for so many years of my life, there weren't any Christians out there prepared to talk to me or give me the evidences that I needed. So he's convinced there's a lot of other Canadians like him. We're also convinced. So I just appreciate your prayers that we'll be able to get that message across and motivate some more Canadians to move out there and share their faith and share the evidences for the Christian faith. I just got back from Arizona. We did a Veritas Forum at Arizona State University. I didn't realize that's the fourth largest campus in the country. And it was wonderful from many perspectives. The first talk I gave to faculty on that campus, four Christian astronomers came up and introduced themselves to me. And these guys are active. They're really active sharing their faith. And, you know, they had never heard of Reasons to Believe, so they're all excited, and we were all excited talking to one another. So it's a wonderful new resource we've tapped into. And it was especially good because the whole week's event closed off with a dialogue with an atheist astronomer. We'll hook him in with a four Christians, so we'll see how that goes. That was interesting, too, because he was basically denying our personal testimonies and didn't want to deal with our content. And I said, well, isn't that interesting that this atheist astronomer doesn't want to touch the science? But Rudy was in the business of saying, you guys can't be true Christians because I don't like your testimony. So, well, how can you argue against somebody's personal story? I mean, this really did happen. So, but anyway, it's good to know that we got some contacts with him. Walter Bradley was there. He's a fellow who's done some articles for us in Facts and Faith. In fact, we're going to be bringing Walter Bradley on our staff as a research associate, having him develop a book for us. And but, you know, every time I hear him speak, he always brings the latest Aggie joke. I mean, he teaches at Texas A&M, so what do you expect? And he just told me, he says, you know, that school has come out with six books. It's volumes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 of Texas A&M Aggie jokes. So, but this is the latest one, the very latest one. And it's about this guy who's an agricultural student at Texas A&M. And he has graduated, and he's trying to get a sales job. And the guy's head of the company says, well, here's your first assignment. I want you to go out into the streets and sell toothbrushes. And I'm not going to tell you how to do it. I want you to see what you could do on your own. You come back, tell me how you do, and then we'll talk about some training to go from there. So he went out for 3 weeks into malls selling toothbrushes. He came back after the 3 weeks, and his boss said, well, how did you do? He said, I didn't sell a single toothbrush. 3 weeks. Nothing happened. And he says, well, let me give you a sales tip, then you can take it from there. And here's the sales tip. What you have to do is identify our product with a felt need of the customer. Now, take that out into the field and see what happens. Okay, the guy comes back 1 week later, and he says, boss, I've cleaned out the warehouse. And where can I get more toothbrushes? And he says, well, how many did you sell? I says, I sold 15,000. And the boss says, look, our entire sales team has not retailed that many toothbrushes in an entire year. What did you do? And he says, well, I said, forget the malls. I went to the airport. And what I did is I made up some dip. I said, you know, big pile of chips and a big pile of dip. And I went to the airport and gave away free dip. And what happened was people would eat the dip and they say, gee, this tastes like cow dung. And he says, well, that's because it is cow dung. Would you like to buy a toothbrush? All right. You know, felt need.
Is that on tape?
All right. You have to give Walter the credit for that, though. It's not mine. All right. Credit? Okay. He says the school gives him a cut on those six books, but... anyways, we're into Genesis chapter 1. And what I appreciate about this class is how much I learn after each class is over. You know, people come up afterwards and all the really tough questions that they feel would be a little inappropriate to ask in front of this class. It really isn't, but you know, I always notice that the real zingers always come up when it's kind of one-on-one afterwards. And I was just amazed at how well people anticipated where we're going in this class. So I just want to encourage you to keep that up. But what I tried to do last week was kind of close out the 6 days of creation. And there were a couple of loose ends that I didn't quite get to. We're going to kind of close up those loose ends. But you know what? Every one of those loose ends was brought up with the people that came up afterwards and posed questions. So this is a sharp class. I appreciate the way you really stay on top of your toes, but also feel free to bring it up in class. It's good stuff. What we did last week, by the way, have we introduced new people here? I think
no,
we forgot to do that.
Didn't do that.
Well, let's do that real quickly. Anybody in this class who's new to the class? Yes, Tom. Your son, Eric. Well, great. Yeah, good to see you again. All right. And where are you from? Arcadia. All right. Long walk. Okay. Anyone else on this side? How about this side of the class? Yes.
This is my sister Barbara.
Your sister Barbara. Uh-huh.
From Mariposa.
From Mariposa. Well, that's a little bit longer walk than Arcadia. All right. Pretty good hike, yeah. Well, I brought my son's skateboard with me today, and everybody thought I skateboarded over here from San Dimas. And I said, no, not quite. He left it in the car. I do rollerblade, however. Anyone else here in the class?
Rollerblade?
No. That's new, all right? I didn't know you did that, Tom. So my doctor's kind of upset, but I've yet to fall. I mean, but he says, you know, it's different when you're older than when you're a kid. I'll find out, I guess. All right. Well, what we've been doing in this class is a course on science and the Bible, and we've spent quite a bit of time looking at the scientific evidences for the God of the Bible. But it's one thing to prove to people that the God of the Bible exists, is quite another to demonstrate that he reveals himself accurately in the pages of the Bible. So we're doing that in terms of the scientific content. And of course, the greatest challenge for demonstrating the Bible's the error-free word of God, not just for faith and practice, but science, history, and all disciplines, would be the first 11 chapters of Genesis. For very good reason, because that contains content that today, at least, it's the easiest to test. And so this is where skeptics have their greatest problems with the Bible as the Word of God, but this is also a place where we Christians can derive the strongest evidences for the Bible as the Word of God. So it has both problems and opportunities, because of all the passages we see in the Bible, it's these first 11 chapters that most directly address scientific issues. And it's not that things like the virgin birth aren't important. The problem is that scientists today can't go back and do experiments on the virgin birth because we can't even find the body of Mary. So, but in terms of the Earth, it's still around for us to measure. The universe is still here. The fossil record is there. These are all things that can be checked out. We get into the flood, we're going to find that there is material there that can be subjected to scientific testing. So that's kind of the direction we're moving. All right. But what we were looking at last week were the events of the fourth, fifth, and sixth creation days. And again, just as a quick review, the key to correctly interpreting Genesis chapter 1, at least in my opinion, is to recognize that we have to follow the scientific method for good reason. That's where the scientific method comes from. It's derived from the Bible. And that is that we are to discipline ourselves not to make any interpretation until we've correctly identified the point of view or the frame of reference and the initial conditions. That point of view, the Spirit of God is brooding over the surface of the waters, underneath the cloud layer, not above the cloud layer, the four initial conditions. The earth starts off empty of life, unfit for life. It's dark upon the surface of the waters, and there's water over the entire surface of the earth. Then you move through the first 3 days of creation. Light passes through this opaque atmosphere because it's transformed to translucency. We have a water cycle set up with waters above the ocean, waters below the ocean. Third creation day, continental land masses begin to pop up above the surface of the waters, and the land now produces plants. And in the fourth creation day, this atmosphere transforms again, so that instead of light merely passing through the atmosphere, at least on occasion in different geographical spots, is made transparent, where the observer on the surface of the waters can for the first time see the objects that are responsible for the light. Sun, moon, and stars were created before the 6 days of creation, but they don't appear to the observer until the fourth creation day. Moving into the fifth creation day, and this is one thing I do want to pick up on, the text begins with the charettes. The charettes are these swarms of small sea creatures. And as I mentioned last week, this Hebrew word, charettes, has a rather broad meaning. It basically refers to small creatures that are neither terribly primitive nor terribly advanced. So it's not a word you would use for, say, bacteria or algae. And it's not a word that you would use for elephants. But it would be a word that would be appropriate to almost everything that fits in between. And I was talking to Don as we walked in here today, and he pointed out that his little computer program popped up the word charettes, and it had all these different definitions. All right, what I'm going to do is show you some of the problems that secularists have with this term charettes because of the way it is used not just in this passage but other passages of the Bible. And I really didn't cover that last week. I kind of focused just what Genesis 1 was speaking about. Now, the thing we notice here is identifies sea charettes. The question that comes up would be, are there land charettes? The answer is yes. The text does not deal with land charettes. It's only dealing with sea charettes. And as I mentioned last week, it would encompass things like mollusks, crabs, oysters, clams, sea cucumbers, you could think of jellyfish. Creatures like that would be covered. Now, the really big stuff would not be covered. The really tiny stuff would not be covered. It's also dealing with those creatures that are capable of reproducing in very large numbers. So it's not referring to creatures that produce, say, one offspring per year. No, we're talking about things like frogs that make, you know, thousands and thousands of eggs and are capable of reproducing very quickly, given the right circumstances and the lack of predators. But it is also the case that the Bible speaks of charettes that are land-based as opposed to charettes that are sea-based. Now, this leads to some difficulty for secularists because of what we encounter on the sixth creation day, the creatures that creepeth along the ground. Now, In the King James Bible, it uses that term on the sixth creation day that God made three kinds of animals, the wild animals, the tameable animals, and the creatures that creepeth along the ground. Where certain astute skeptics will make a criticism of the Bible is what you see in Leviticus chapter 11, starting in verse 39. Let me just read this to you. And the word for creature in each case is sherets. Okay. If an animal that you're allowed to eat dies, anyone who touches the carcass will be unclean until evening. Anyone who eats some of the carcass must wash his clothes, and he'll be unclean until evening. Anyone who picks up the carcass must wash his clothes, he'll be unclean till evening. Here we go, verse 41. Every sherets that moves about on the ground is detestable. It's not to be eaten. You're not to eat any sherets that moves about on the ground, whether it moves on its belly, or walks on all fours, or on many feet, it is detestable. Do not defile yourself by any of these sherets. Do not make yourself unclean by means of them, or to be made unclean by them. Now, I'm giving you the word in the original Hebrew. You want to know what's there in the English? Creature. Okay, that causes a problem, because you go back to Genesis chapter 1, that word creature is used exclusively for nephesh, soulish animals. So you read this in Leviticus chapter 11 as a skeptic without any real knowledge or background on what's going on in the Hebrew language. You say, well, it says creature here. I go back to Genesis 1. It says creature there. It must be the same kind of animal. And the truth is it's not. It's sherets here, whereas back in Genesis 1, it's nephesh. But unfortunately, the English translation uses the same word creature for each one. So, that's one thing we need to recognize, is that, now, what we're really dealing with here in the Hebrew language is that there's very few Hebrew nouns for animals, period. You can count them on two hands, the number of Hebrew words that you can use to describe various different kinds of animals. And so, it shouldn't be shocking to us that in certain contexts of the Bible, a particular Hebrew noun for animal might take on a different meaning or definition than it would take on in a different passage. I mean, what are you going to do if you got such a short list? Now, again, I said many of these problems we encounter about trying to critique the science of the Genesis accounts is a failure to recognize the difficulty of translating from a very tiny vocabulary language, namely Hebrew, into an enormous vocabulary language, namely English. And you probably couldn't pick two worse extremes. Biblical Hebrew, barely more than 3,000 words total. English, more than 4 million. So how many words do we have in English to describe different kinds of animals? I don't know, we got biologists here, who got a couple right here. I don't know how many, but it's a long list. I mean, we come up with a different name for every species of animal we identify. That easily gets us past 1 million right there. So in the English language, we'd have literally a million, yeah. Is Leviticus chapter 11, verse 39, and I really didn't finish it. Let me finish the rest of it before we get into all this preaching and teaching. Do not defy yourself by any of these creatures, the word is sherets. Do not make yourself unclean by means of them, or be made unclean by them. I am the Lord your God. Concentrate yourself and be holy, because I am holy. Do not make yourself unclean by any creature, that is sherets, that moves about on the ground. Now, that's important because it's the same language you encounter in the sixth creation day for those creatures that move about along the ground, but it's a different word. It's not the same word. I am the Lord who brought you up out of Egypt to be your God. Therefore, be holy because I am holy. These are the regulations concerning animals. That's behemah, birds, every living thing, nephesh, that moves in the water, and every creature, nephesh, that moves about on the ground. So this is a bit confusing. It talks about two different kinds of creatures that move about on the ground, one identified as sherets-type creature, the other identified as a nephesh-type creature. Okay, what's really going on here in the Old Testament is that if you're talking about creatures that move along the ground, that would be sherets, that can include these little tiny lizards and snakes and insects and amphibians. But if you're talking creatures that move about along the ground, nephesh, these are the short-legged mammals. What we talked about last week, the rats, the rodents, mice, maybe rabbits as well. But you know, this here chapter in Leviticus kind of explores the possibility. Shretz can take on a very broad definition, but in Genesis 1 it specifies sea shretz, so we don't get confused with land shretz. But the problem is the text never addresses land shretz. Leviticus does, but nowhere in Genesis 1 does it speak about what God did to bring about the existence of land shretz. But I want you to be aware that in the Hebrew, in the Old Testament, it does address land shretz. Genesis 1 doesn't, but it is addressed elsewhere in the five books of Moses. Yes, it does. But yeah, but that's in the sixth creation day, right? And it's under the broad title of nephesh type creatures. So creatures that creep along the ground that are soulish would be the short-legged guys. Okay, squirrels, rabbits, etc. It's not referring to insects. And incidentally, this little phrase here, move about on all fours, that could include insects. You say, well, fours, that's four legs. Well, you're reading it a little too woodenly. This is, somebody's trying to, you know, here's this guy trying to translate from the original, and what it really means is it's moving about on a few legs as opposed to many legs. I mean, the contrast here is great. It talks about creatures that move on all fours and creatures that move about on many legs. The real contrast here is between centipedes and millipedes as opposed to those that walk about on two legs or four legs or six legs or eight legs. So moving about on all fours would probably include everything up to spiders. In terms of numbers of legs, if they got more than eight, they wouldn't be included. So it's just kind of an idiomatic phrase that comes across here in the English. All right. Any questions or comments on that? I'm reading from the New International Version. It uses the word creatures all the way down, which is kind of unfortunate because the New International Version very seldom uses the word creature for anything other than nephesh. But this is an exception. It's using the word creature when the original says shretz. The newer swarming things that swarm. That's a more accurate translation. That's the New American Standard, yes. Well, I mean, you want me to give you the Hebrew letters? I mean, I just say that because when you transliterate from the Hebrew into the English, you usually have a few options. Shretz is pretty close to how the Hebrew actually sounds. But there are other ways to spell it, huh? It won't be in your dictionary, no. But if you look up, say, a lexical aid or even something like Strong's Concordance, what it'll do is it'll take those Hebrew letters and translate it as best as possible into English. Yes, Tony. Tony, it's worse than that. You can go through the Bible and you'll find places where shretz is used for reptiles. You'll also find places in the Bible where nephesh is used for reptiles. You say, gee, they just can't get it straight. Well, I mean, it's very reasonable. We only got two handfuls worth of nouns to cover all the animal kingdom. I'm not at all surprised that these definitions take on different contexts and different passages. Well, are you saying the shretz were more general or more specific? Okay. I'll give you my best take on this, because, again, because of how few nouns there are, there's a little bit of disagreement here. Is that both words could be, don't have to be, but could be used to refer to reptiles. But what's really coming across the definition is that they're charettes, they're small, and they reproduce very efficiently in terms of what could happen if there aren't a lot of predators. Whereas if it's a nephesh-type reptile, we're talking something bigger that produces fewer offspring each time they get pregnant. But there are scholars who say, well, maybe we shouldn't take the word that way. I mean, it's really difficult given the fact that there are so few nouns and how they're used interchangeably in different texts. But that's my best take on it. The basic idea is swarming creatures, small swarming creatures. Well, if they're going to swarm, you kind of get the idea it's kind of like flies. I mean, within a few months you get a whole bunch where you started off with only two. Wait a minute. Charettes does not have to refer to just creeping-type creatures, okay? You can use it for clams or oysters or crabs, insects, frogs. It's a much more general term. Exactly. So, what I kind of said last week and the beginning of this week, creatures that are not terribly primitive, but neither are they terribly advanced. They kind of fit in between. They're small creatures, and they have the capacity, or at least the potential, for dramatic reproduction. And you usually find a lot of them when you run into them. It's kind of like, locusts. I mean, you seldom see just one. So, but again, look at it from the Hebrew perspective. If you're looking at it from biblical Hebrew, if you want to describe a reptile that's really big and only produces one or two offspring each time, what word are you going to use? Well, if you look at all the options, nephesh is it. Now, that doesn't mean that nephesh can't take on a narrower definition, which I think is what's going on in Genesis chapter 1. It's not referring to reptiles, in my opinion. It's focusing on birds and mammals. See, what's your proof for that? Look at the verbs. All right, the noun's not going to give you the detail you need, but the verbs will. The fact that it uses a sa, bara, there's something brand new about these creatures. They're manufactured by God. That's my justification for saying it's specific to birds and to mammals. So it's tricky because you got so few nouns to work with. You got to use other tactics, grammatical tactics, to figure out, how should we understand these particular nephesh creatures. Yes?
So the days, when you say days, that's not like a 24-hour
day. No, we'll get into that.
Okay.
I got a whole book on that. And the problem there, again, is that because the Hebrew language is so tiny, words that in English would be figurative may not be figurative in the original. For example, if we were to look at the word day in English, it has several figurative definitions, but only two literal definitions. But in the Hebrew language, it has three literal definitions. So when it gets translated into English, we say, well, this interpretation of Genesis 1 has got to be figurative, whereas this interpretation is literal. And my response is no, they're all literal. We have to find out which one is both literal and consistent. Incidentally, that's the challenge I'm going to be facing in Canada. There's a bunch of churches up there that are convinced the only literal reading of Genesis 1 is that these days of creation are 24-hour consecutive periods. And my response is that the six long periods of time is just as literal an interpretation as six 24-hour periods. But only one of those two would be both literal and consistent with all 66 books of the Bible. So when you look at it in a larger context, we'll do that. And Rudy, that's one of those issues that can't be solved just looking at Genesis 1 by itself. Actually, you could argue it could be solved if you just move over one chapter. If you look at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 together, you can figure out how long those creation days are. Genesis 1 by itself, it's more difficult, not impossible, but more difficult. And incidentally, one way to deal with some of these things, like the charrettes, the days, we're going to talk about evening and morning, the controversy over it was so. All of these things are really non-essentials to the doctrine of salvation. They're also non-essentials for biblical inerrancy. And I mentioned that because if you're convinced otherwise, it'll be very difficult to rationalize your way through this text. That came up when I was at Arizona State University, as one professor asked the question, well, how come it's so much easier for non-Christians to figure out what this text is saying than Christians to figure out what this text is saying? And there's an easy answer. Non-Christians are not going to be perturbed by what they think are salvation issues. All right? So they don't think their salvation is a state. They don't even have salvation yet. So, in that sense, they can come to the text without the emotional baggage of someone, say, raised in a Christian home and say, boy, you better believe this or else. And they say, well, I'm not sure I can believe it. And they're afraid to deal with the issues. So that's the response I gave to that professor, is that yeah, it could be much easier for a non-Christian because of that lack of baggage. Yes. Yeah, I got that in every lecture I gave at Arizona State. Yeah, I gave five lectures, and it came up every single time. Mainly because there's a very prominent young earth creationist who's preaching that line that we must take the days in Genesis 1 as 24-hour periods because of the Ten Commandments. For 6 days you shall work, the seventh day you shall rest, and they say that proves the days are 24 hours. We'll hit that one, but it's there's an exegetical error there. What you see in the English translation is the imposition of a definite article that's not there in the original. You take that definite article out, and it indicates that there's a lot more flexibility on the interpretation of that passage than you would otherwise get. But there's an even easier way to deal with it. In that same context, it's in the book of Exodus. You know, here's Moses bringing from God these laws. And what you notice there is it lays out a Sabbath rest for humanity, but it also lays out a Sabbath rest for the agricultural land. And they're not identical time periods. Therefore, why should we presume that God's day of rest is to be equated with man's day of rest? It might be equated with the agricultural land or something entirely different. And the principle there in the Decalogue is one of working six, resting one. Working six, resting one. And it just so happens that for human beings, the way we're biologically structured, working six 24-hour periods and resting on the seventh for 24 hours is the best way for us to recover biologically. Whereas for the agricultural land, 6 years working, seventh year rest the land, that fits the biology of the soil. We have a different biology than the soil. Now, what about God's biology? Should we equate God's biology with either the soil or humanity? Hey, God the Father is spirit. So in that sense, you could say he is non-biological. So in that case, the equation falls apart. Exodus chapter 20, verses 10 and 11, what we have there is an analogy, not an equation. And given that God has a capacity to work in the equivalent of at least three dimensions of time, I mean, he could make 24 hours in any period he wants, greater or lesser. And we kind of demonstrate that in Beyond the Cosmos. What for us would be 24 hours, for God could be zero time, or a nanosecond, or it could be infinite time, or quadrillions of years. All you got to do is look at time in a plane, and you can make those two timelines intersect at whatever angle you want. According to the angle, you can make time stretch or not stretch. That's why the Bible says a day of the Lord is like 1,000 years. 1,000 years is like a day. God can move time in either direction. He has that capacity. Okay, I had fun bringing that stuff out last week. Yes. Yes. Ted.
Quick question. You say that there are a few nouns in the language. Referring to class nouns as opposed to personal nouns.
Yeah, I'm not talking about nouns with a capital N. Okay.
You're not talking about the nouns
No, I am. Okay. I mean, if you want virtually the whole list, you can go to the flood accounts, and it gives you every word you can possibly use to refer to a bird or a mammal. And it's quite a short list. And then the words you have for animals that are not bird and mammal is even shorter. So the entire list of nouns available in the Hebrew language is very brief. But you say, well, how about nouns for people? Yeah, they got lots of nouns for people. But, you know, that's noun with a capital letter as opposed to noun with a small letter. Yes, you're next. I was in Tempe. I was right at the campus of Arizona State. Yes. So, Arizona State University. University of Arizona is in Tucson. So. Okay, that's a good question. I mean, here are us 20th century citizens reading Genesis, and why did he choose such a limited language to tell us about these events of creation? Why didn't he pick a different language? Well, first of all, it's really only late 20th century readers that would have the kind of capacity to dig into this text to the depth that we're doing. I mean, just go back even 50 years. There wasn't enough scientific knowledge to bring about the kind of criticisms of the text that are popular today. So, why choose a language that would focus on only one generation, ignore all the other generations? And then you can go back to the question, well, this was written in around 1450 BC. What other languages could you have chosen? The Greek language wasn't developed at this point. I mean, so your choices were very limited in terms of a written language that you could use. You could use Egyptian hieroglyphics, and how grateful I am that it wasn't written in Egyptian hieroglyphics. You could use one of the Babylonian languages, or you could use Hebrew. So, now it's possible Chinese was in vogue back then, but I'm kind of glad it wasn't written in Chinese either. And really, the whole intent was this. God took Abraham and said, leave the land of Mesopotamia. And he put Abraham at the juncture of three continents. The reason for that is, you know, transportation and communication weren't as advanced today. His intent was that by putting his chosen people at the juncture of three continents, that caravan trade travel would force the dissemination of the gospel message. Because the peoples would have to pass through the land of Canaan in their communications with one another, and they would come into contact with God's people and the written message. That means then that God was needing to deal with a language that would be available in the context of the Middle East. So now you're down to Middle Eastern languages. And in that sense, you could argue that Hebrew really is the best choice. It has greater precision than the Babylonian languages and doesn't have the alphabet problem of the Egyptian languages. Moreover, we need to realize that the Old Testament is primarily not a scientific doctrinal document to the same degree that we see in the New Testament. You may have noticed that. You read the Old Testament, it's dealing with different content than the New Testament. The New Testament is highly didactic, highly doctrinal. There's a lot of that in the Old Testament, but much more so, it's describing God's actions, describing the history of God's people and God's dealing with God's people. There's a lot more emotional content in the Old Testament than you find in the New Testament. There's more humor in the Old Testament than there is in the New Testament. Well, the Hebrew language is a superior language to the Hebrew for describing that kind of action and interchange of emotions than the Greek. But the Greek is much more powerful in communicating abstract doctrinal points. And so God chose Greek for the New Testament. He chose Hebrew for the Old Testament. And you could say, well, why didn't he choose an even more advanced language than Hebrew and Greek? Yes, but those advanced languages didn't develop to centuries after the coming of Jesus Christ. Well, why didn't he make Jesus Christ come in the 19th century instead of the first century when we'd have all this stuff? Well, I'd say God was in a hurry. God was not willing that the human species would have to wait that long to see the one who would bring about their redemption. And, you know, one scholar looked at it this way. You know, God placed Jesus Christ on the earth with his ministry so that there'd be a portion of the human population that could look forward to what God was going to do, and there'd be a portion that could look back, and, you know, God kind of cut it so that there'd be a goodly portion looking each direction. And therefore, God didn't pick the beginning of history, human history, neither did he pick the end of human history. He kind of stuck it in the middle. So that kind of gives you an idea why he chose the language, why he chose Abraham, why he put Abraham where he did, and then why we have the Old Testament and the New Testament written in these two languages. Yes. Well, my kids asked me that when I said, well, let's read the story of Elijah on Mount Carmel. And they were really laughing. Okay? Now, the satire there is so cutting that not many translations translate it precisely. This is where King James kind of really toned it down. The reason was that the satire that you see there really wasn't, in Elizabethan times, appropriate for public audiences. I mean, you got phrases like there, you know, here's Elijah mocking the God of the false prophets and says, maybe your God can't hear you. Maybe he's sitting on the toilet and he's constipated. All right. Well, yeah, look it up in your Bible. You'll see it. If you got one of the newer translations, it'll come out that way. But the reason you don't see it in King James, or for that matter, the Revised Standard Version, that wasn't appropriate for polite company. And so they toned it down a bit. But the more modern translations are getting a little more faithful to the Hebrew text. But you really need something like the Living Bible Translation, which kind of focuses on the emotion much more, that brings it out. And the point here is you need more than one translation. If you're reading something like the New American Standard Version, as we heard here, it was very precise on the treatment of the charrettes in Genesis 11, better than the other translations. But because of the focus of those translators on the precision of the original words, a lot of the humor got dropped. I mean, if you're going word for word from one language, I mean, try that. Try translating from one language into another language, being extremely precise about word for word definitions with a joke. Almost never will the joke get through. All right? So, yeah. We probably had those kinds of experiences. Okay. Yes. I think you're really on target there, Mel, that if you're trying to write a book for all peoples, it'd be far harder to go with something with 4 million words and translate into something that's got only 3,000 or 4,000 words than to go the other way around. You're going to get a lot more lost in the translation. But that's one reason why I recommend that if you're a serious Bible student, have several different translations. Because not one single translation is going to bring out all the meaning in the communication of the original. So, for example, if you want to get a real good handle on the humor of the Old Testament, New American Standard is not going to do it for you. I'm not trying to put it down. I think it's a very good translation. I use the New American Standard, however, when I'm witnessing to Jehovah's Witnesses about the Old Testament teaching on the Trinity. It's the best translation I've found to point out that the words of the Old Testament, the Hebrew words, really do teach in an unambiguous way the doctrine that God is singular and plural at the same time, that the Messiah is fully God. If I use the Living Bible, it's not going to work. Why? Because the Living Bible is so much focused on translating accurately the emotional content of the text. My kids ask me, well, where's all this funny stuff in the Old Testament? And we want to laugh. Well, I'll dig out the Living Bible. And there it actually talks about this false god sitting on the toilet and getting constipated. And there's more than that. I mean, if you read there, you'll see that. Roughly.
Concordance and look up toilet.
Or constipated. In fact, I think the New International Version actually does use the word constipated. So, but the end of 1 Kings would be where I would go. And, where it talks about Elijah on Mount Carmel, that 3-year drought in Israel. And this is where he says, okay, bring all your false prophets up to the mountain. We're going to have a contest. And, that's the one where he puts up those two altars. Says, okay, you sacrifice first. And see what he's doing. All these false prophets are trying to get fire to come down out of heaven by their God. And Elijah purposely says, you go first. And here they are dancing around and cutting themselves with knives and they're bleeding, which is part of their occult practices. And he mocks them the whole time. So all day long, Elijah there is taunting and mocking these false prophets. There are so many of you, there's only one of me. You've been doing this for hour after hour after hour. Nothing's happening. And then he taunts them with these things. Well, gee, maybe your God is asleep and needs to be awakened. Maybe he doesn't have an alarm clock. So, this is the kind of stuff he throws up. And he just keeps at it. And he says, okay, let me show you what our God can do. And what he does is just in a few minutes. Here are these false prophets all day long. Being provoked by Elijah. That's basically what he's doing, saying, hey, guys, come up with your best stuff. And so he keeps needling them, and they can't come up with anything. And he says, okay, you've seen these guys sweat and bleed and dance for 8 or 9 hours. In just a few minutes, I'm going to show you what the God of heaven can do. Okay, there you go. All right. The other thing that came up last week, which I think is really good, I was making the comment that on the fifth creation day, the text speaks about God creating. It says, let the oceans produce these charettes, the verb dashah. Now we move into asah bara, where God manufactures these birds and sea mammals, and he creates these birds and sea mammals. Why two verbs? Because we're talking soulless creatures. They have never existed before. What we had before the fifth creation day were creatures that were physical only. Now the text is talking about God bringing something brand new into existence, creatures that are not only physical, but also soulish. And it identifies birds and sea mammals as those creatures that fall into that category. Yes?
That doesn't mean like they'll go to heaven.
Doesn't mean that they go to heaven. Okay? Now, that's kind of a touchy subject. Okay, I didn't really want to deal with that right now. We'll get to that. But yeah, your pet dog is not going to be there with you. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be like creatures in heaven with you. God, that doesn't say for sure. I can't promise you there'll be dogs in heaven. But neither can I say, all right. Yeah, if Disney's going to be your authority, then you're all set. So, okay. No, but I would concede that the text does not rule out that possibility, but I would argue that the dog that was part of your family for 15 years and died would not be there. All creatures go to the dust. We go to the dust too, but there's something about us that survives that dust experience, and that's the spirit. We alone are body, soul, and spirit. The birds and mammals are body and soul only. That component is temporal. The spirit is not temporal. it goes on forever. We're the one species that God created that will survive the replacement of this universe with a brand new universe. And that's because we alone have those three components of body, soul, and spirit. But my point was that these creatures are brand new. The soul never existed before. That's why you have the word bara to create brand new. The asam means that God personally manufactured them. So this is a miracle. It's a miracle either way, that God manufactured these creatures. He did it himself. But it's also a miracle he placed within them something that never existed before. So it's both kinds of miracles. Yes. The army of the Lord comes back riding on horses. Okay. But now, both of you are students of our Revelation class, right? Okay, what's the answer? That's before the millennium. It's before this universe gets replaced by a brand new universe. Now, if you read Revelation 21 and 22, does it ever mention horses? No, it doesn't. Revelation 20, so that's a trick. There is a reference to a horse in Revelation 20, but that's still previous to the new creation. So, no horses there. Now, does that mean there will not be horses? I didn't say that. The text didn't say that. There may be horses there, but they're simply not mentioned in the text. So now, are there going to be extra-dimensional horses? I mean, that's... Again, there's a lot of different ways you could go with this. Okay. Now, before I got off track here, all right, what came up last week was this. I made a point that land mammals are not mentioned in the text until the sixth creation day. But there are three specialized kinds of land mammals. The fossil record tells us that land mammals were there very early in the history of mammalian life. And so some people have critiqued this, biologists in particular, and say, this has got to be wrong, because the fossil record tells us land animals, then sea mammals, and the Bible here is saying sea mammals, then land mammals. But the response I gave last week is that when we look in the fifth creation day, it's speaking of birds and sea mammals generically. When we look at the sixth creation day, it doesn't even use the word for nephesh. Rather, it immediately goes to three specialized kinds of land mammals. So it's not speaking about land mammals generically. It's speaking about three specialized kinds of land mammals, in particular those land mammals that will cohabit with humanity. Now, one of you was quite sharp on this and made this point. This is really an historical problem rather than a real up-to-date problem. By up-to-date, I mean in the last 12 months. And this criticism that the Bible was misplaced in the order of events, the fossil record says land mammals and sea mammals, whereas we know it was the land mammals came first and sea mammals. The Bible puts sea mammals first and land mammals. That's really an artifact of what was taught in paleontology classes 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. When the fossil record was less complete, what we saw was evidence for rather ancient land mammals. By ancient, I mean 40 and 50 million years ago. So these land mammals were really early, and the evidence we had for sea mammals was like 1, 2, 3, 5, 6 million years ago. And so I looked at the Bible and said, this is dead wrong. Therefore, the Bible is not worthy of any attention. My point was last week is that criticism does not apply. But the latest situation is this. We have fossil record evidence for sea mammals going back at least 52 million years. Now, we have slightly earlier evidence for land mammals, like 55, maybe even as far back as 60 million years ago. 55 is kind of where the definitive evidence stops. But the point is, that's not really significantly different. It could well be that the fossil record has the creation of land mammals and sea mammals at roughly the same time. So this criticism that the fossil record says sea mammals are very late, land mammals are very early, has been refuted by the latest fossil discoveries. Even things like whales, as you saw in our Facts and Faith newsletter a few months back, date back as early as 52 million years. These are rather advanced sea mammals, and they date quite early in the fossil record. So it may not even be true that the natural record significantly places land mammals before sea mammals. But it's academic because the text is not speaking about land mammals generically on the sixth creation day, rather the three different kinds of land mammals that God intends would be relating to human beings. Okay, but thanks for bringing up last week. That all happened in about a 4-minute window after class last week. And it was all part of my plan to teach. I wasn't planning to teach it today. I was going to teach it a little bit later, but this is great. Good stuff here. Now, oh boy, I only got a couple minutes left. There's a few things we need to do to finish up chapter 1. We've dealt with one, I think, already, which was you go through the text and you notice it repeats certain things. It repeats the phrase, and it was so. It repeats the phrase, it was good. It repeats the phrase of evenings and mornings. And it repeats this phrase of numbering the days. Why does the text do this? And what are the hang-ups here? Well, one of the hang-ups we dealt with already. You look at Genesis chapter 2, and it doesn't say it was good. You look at the other 5 days, it says it was good. In fact, if you look at the third day, it says it was good twice. So how come the second day is not good? Now, I'm putting that in the context of challenges. You know, that's one of the questions we get at Reasons to Believe. God couldn't have done a very good job because when it gets to the second creation day, he doesn't tell us it's good. And what was the mistake he made in the second creation day? Now, the response to that is, well, after you get through the 6 days, you know, keep reading. Get past the sixth creation day and keep reading and read on until the first few verses of Genesis 2. And really the chapter break takes place between Genesis 2:3 and Genesis 2:4. What does it tell us? Or look at the 31st verse of Genesis 1. God saw all that he had made and it was very good. That includes the second creation day. So, that summary sentence for the 6 days of creation declares all of it. Not just good, but very good. And yes, that word all is in the original. So, it means everything that God did in the 6 days of creation is not only good, but very good. So, don't worry about the fact that there was no, it was good for the second creation day. That we covered. But somebody pressed me on this. Not here, but when I was back in Kansas a couple of weeks ago. All right, why still does the text not say it was good on the second creation day? Now, the easy answer is, well, it's covered by that summary sentence. But maybe there is something going on here in terms of why God dropped it from the text. Want to take a stab at it, Tony? Yeah, it's not in the Hebrew text, but they saw the benefit of sticking it in because of that summary statement. Well, let me just throw this out as a suggestion, and let me preface that by saying this is speculative. There's one little speculative insight I can give as to why maybe not. Remember we were going through the details of the first and second creation days? And how God had to have this collision of planet Earth occur so the atmosphere would be transformed, so Earth would be blessed with a thin atmosphere instead of the heavy atmosphere it should have had, and just how incredibly fine-tuned that cosmic collision had to be in order to make that possible. You also have to fine-tune the mass of the Earth and the position of the Earth and on. We give a long list of things that have to be very carefully fine-tuned in order to bring about the transformation of the atmosphere from translucent to transparent. But those same list of items that must be fine-tuned would also bring about the setting up of a stable water cycle. Therefore, it's possible that God did it all in one set of miracles, bringing about the events of the first creation day as well as the events of the third creation day, and therefore the it was good of the first creation day covers the fulfillment of the events of the second creation day. Now, God didn't have to do it that way, but from a scientific perspective, we could look at what did take place and say he could have. He could have done one set of fine-tuned creation miracles that would have accomplished in due time the events of both the first and the second creation day. therefore, maybe that's why it's not stuck in the text. But you could say, well, wait a minute. You know, only an astrophysicist or a geophysicist living at the end of the 20th century is going to pick it up. That can't be sufficient basis for omitting it from the text. I probably agree with you. Yeah, maybe this is just a speculative statement. If you demand a reason, that's one I can suggest. If you want a better reason, well, I'd say once you're dead and up there in heaven, you can ask God himself. I'm sure he'll give you a much better reason. Okay, time's up. Let me just give a brief word of prayer, and then we'll pick this up next time. Thank you, Father, for this incredible chapter. A chapter that you've allowed us at the end of the 20th century to see in a light that no other generation's been able to see. I pray we'd be able to take that light, the evidence that we can give that this is true to an amazingly high precision, amazing degree of accuracy. You'd enable us to use this as a means to demonstrate to people that you have spoken, that you've declared, and how dare we ignore the message of the King of the Cosmos, a king that loves us to the degree that he's demonstrated through nature. So, Father, I pray this would be an effective tool for us to encourage others to take your message seriously. In Jesus' name, amen.